They maintained the knowledge. John the Digg's family had always been gardeners at Angel Field. In the old days, when the house had a head gardener and seven hands, his great-grandfather had rooted out a box hedge under a window, and so as not to be wasteful, he'd taken hundreds of cuttings a few inches long. He grew them on in a nursery bed, and when they reached 10 inches, he planted them in the garden. He clipped some into low, sharp-edged hedges, let others grow shaggy, and when they were broad enough, took his shears to them and made spheres. Some, he could see, wanted to be pyramids, cones, top hats. To shape his green material, this man with the large, rough hands learned the patient, meticulous delicacy of a lace-maker. He created no animals, no human figures. Not for him the peacocks, lions, life-size men on bicycles that you saw in other gardens. The shapes that pleased him were either strictly geometric or bafflingly, bulgingly abstract. By the time of his last years, the topiary garden was the only thing that mattered. He was always eager to be finished with his other work of the day. All he wanted was to be in his garden, running his hands over the surfaces of the shapes he had made, as he imagined the time, 50, 100 years hence, when his garden would have grown to maturity. At his death, his shears passed into the hands of his son, and decades later, his grandson. Then, when this grandson died, it was John the Digg, who had finished his apprenticeship at a large garden some 30 miles away, who came home to take on the job that had to be his. Although he was only the undergardener, the topiary had been his responsibility from the very beginning. How could it be otherwise? He picked up the shears, their wooden handles worn to shape by his father's hand, and felt his fingers fit the grooves. He was home. In the years after George Angelfield lost his wife, when the number of staff diminished so dramatically, John the Digg stayed on. Gardeners left and were not replaced. When he was still a young man, he became by default head gardener, though he was also the only gardener. The workload was enormous. His employer took no interest. He worked without thanks. There were other jobs, other gardens. He would have been offered any job he had applied for. You only had to see him to trust him. But he never left Angelfield. How could he? Working in the topiary garden, putting his shears into their leather sheath, when the light began to fade, he didn't need to reflect that the trees he was pruning were the very same trees that his great-grandfather had planted, that the routines and motions of his work were the same ones that 3 generations of his family had done before him. All this was too deeply known to require thought. He could take it for granted. Like his trees, he was rooted to Angelfield. What were his feelings that day when he went into the garden and found it ravaged? Great gashes in the sides of the yews, exposing the brown wood of their hearts. The mop heads decapitated, their spherical tops lying at their feet. The perfect balance of the pyramids now lopsided, the cones hacked about, the top hats chopped into and left in tatters. He stared at the long branches, still green, still fresh, that were strewn on the lawn. Their slow shriveling, their curling desiccation, their dying was yet to come. Stunned, with a trembling that seemed to pass from his heart to his legs and into the ground beneath his feet, he tried to understand what had happened. Was it some bolt from the sky that had picked out his garden for destruction? But what freak storm is it that strikes in silence? No, Someone had done this. Turning a corner, he found the proof. Abandoned on the dewy grass, blades agape, the large shears, and next to them the saw. When he didn't come in for lunch, the missus worried, went to find him. Reaching the topiary garden, she raised her hand to her mouth in horror, then gripping her apron, walked on with a new urgency. When she found him, she raised him from the ground. He leaned heavily on her as she led him with tender care to the kitchen and sat him in a chair. She made tea, sweet and hot, and he stared unseeing into space. Without a word, holding the cup to his lips, she tilted sips of the scalding liquid into his mouth. At last his eyes sought hers, and when she saw the loss in them, she felt her own tears spring up. "Oh, Dig, I know." His hands grasped her shoulders, and the shaking of his body was the shaking of her body. The twins did not appear that afternoon, and the missus did not go to find them. When they turned up in the evening, John was still in his chair, white and haggard. He flinched at the sight of them. Curious and indifferent, their green eyes passed over his face just as they had passed over the drawing-room clock. Before she put the twins to bed, the missus dressed the cuts on their hands from the saw and the shears. "Don't touch the things in John's shed," she grumbled. "They're sharp. They'll hurt you." And then, still not expecting to be heeded, "Why did you do it? Oh, why did you do it? You have broken his heart." She felt the touch of a child's hand on hers. "Mrs. Sad," the girl said. It was Emmeline. Startled, the missus blinked away the fog of her tears and stared. The child spoke again. "John the Dig sad." "Yes," the missus whispered. "We are sad." The girl smiled. It was a smile without malice, without guilt. It was simply a smile of satisfaction at having noted something and correctly identified it. She had seen tears. She had been puzzled. But now she had found the answer to the puzzle. It was sadness. The missus closed the door and went downstairs. This was a breakthrough. It was communication. And it was the beginning, perhaps, of something greater than that. Was it possible that one day the girl might understand? She opened the door to the kitchen and went in to rejoin John in his despair.
That night, I had a dream. Walking in Miss Winter's garden, I met my sister. Radiant, she unfolded her vast golden wings as though to embrace me, and I was filled with joy. But when I approached, I saw her eyes were blind, and she couldn't see me. Then despair filled my heart. Waking, I curled into a ball until the stinging heat on my torso had subsided. Merrily and the Perambulator. Miss Winter's house was so isolated, and the life of its inhabitants so solitary, that I was surprised during my first week there to hear a vehicle arriving on the gravel at the front of the house. Peering from the library window, I saw the door of a large black car swing open and caught a glimpse of a tall, dark-haired man. He disappeared into the porch, and I heard the brief ring of the bell. I saw him again the next day. I was in the garden, perhaps 10 feet from the front porch, when I heard the crackle of tires on gravel. I stood still, retreated inside myself. To anyone who took the trouble to look, I was plainly visible. But when people are expecting to see nothing, that's usually what they see. The man did not see me. His face was grave. The heavy line of his brow cast his eyes into shadow, while the rest of his face was distinguished by a numb stillness. He reached into his car for his case, slammed the door, and went up the steps to ring the bell. I heard the door open. Neither he nor Judith spoke a word, and he disappeared inside the house. Later that day, Miss Winter told me the story of Merrily and the perambulator.
As the twins grew older, they explored farther and farther afield, and soon knew all the farms and all the gardens on the estate. They had no sense of boundaries, no understanding of property, and so they went where they wished. They opened gates and didn't always close them. They climbed over fences when they got in their way. They tried kitchen doors, and when they opened, usually they did, people didn't lock doors much in Angelfield, they went inside. They helped themselves to anything tasty in the pantry, slept for an hour on the beds upstairs if they felt weary, took saucepans and spoons away with them to scare birds in the fields. The local families got upset about this. For every accusation made, there was someone who had seen the twins at the relevant time in another distant place. At least they had seen one of them. At least they thought they had. And then it came about that all the old ghost stories were remembered. No old house is without its stories. No old house is without its ghosts. And the very twinness of the girls had a spookiness about it. There was something not right about them, everyone agreed, and whether it was because of the girls themselves or for some other reason, there came to be a disinclination to approach the old house, as much among the adults as the children, for fear of what might be seen there. But eventually the inconvenience of the incursions won ground over the thrill of ghost talk, and the women grew angry. On several occasions they cornered the girls, red-handed, and shouted. Anger pulled their faces all out of shape, and their mouths opened and closed so quickly it made the girls laugh. The women didn't understand why the girls were laughing. They didn't know it was the speed and jumble of the words pouring from their own mouths that had bewildered the twins. They thought it was pure devilment and shouted even more. For a time, the twins stayed to watch the spectacle of the villagers' anger. Then they turned their backs and walked off. When their husbands came home from the fields, the women would complain, say something had to be done, and the men would say, "You're forgetting. They're the children of the big house." And the women said in return, "Big house or no, children didn't ought to be allowed to run riot the way them two girls do. It's not right. Something's got to be done." And the men would sit quiet over their plates of potato and meat and shake their heads, and nothing would be done. Until the incident of the perambulator. There was a woman in the village called Mary Jameson. She was the wife of Fred Jameson, one of the farm labourers, and she lived with her husband and his parents in one of the cottages. The couple were newlyweds, and before her marriage, the woman had been called Mary Lee, which explains the name the twins invented for her in their own language. They called her Merrily, and it was a good name for her. Sometimes she would go and meet her husband from the fields, and they would sit in the shelter of a hedge at the end of the day while he had a cigarette. He was a tall brown man with big feet, and he used to put his arm around her waist and tickle her and blow down the front of her dress to make her laugh. She tried not to laugh, to tease him, but she wanted to laugh, really, and eventually she always did. She'd have been a plain woman if it wasn't for that laugh of hers. Her hair was a dirty colour that was too dark to be blonde. Her chin was big, and her eyes were small. But she had that laugh, and the sound of it was so beautiful that when you heard it, it was as if your eyes saw her through your ears, and she was transformed. Her eyes disappeared altogether above her fat moon cheeks, and suddenly, in their absence, you noticed her mouth. Plump, cherry-coloured lips and even white teeth. No one else in Angelfield had teeth to match hers, and a little pink tongue that was like a kitten's. And the sound. That beautiful, rippling, unstoppable music that came gurgling out of her throat like spring water from an underground stream. It was the sound of joy. He married her for it. And when she laughed, his voice went soft, and he put his lips against her neck and said her name, Mary, over and over again. And the vibration of his voice on her skin tickled her and made her laugh, and laugh, and laugh. Anyway, during the winter, while the twins kept to the gardens and the park, Merrily had a baby. The first warm days of spring found her in the garden, hanging out little clothes on a line. Behind her was a black perambulator. Heaven knows where it had come from. It wasn't the usual kind of thing for a village girl to have. No doubt it was some second or third-hand thing bought cheap by the family, though no doubt seeming very dear, in order to mark the importance of this first child and grandchild. In any case, as Merrily bent for another little vest, another little chemise, and pegged them on the line, she was singing, like one of the birds that were singing too, and her song seemed destined for the beautiful black perambulator. Its wheels were silver and very high, so although the carriage was large and black and rounded, the impression was of speed and weightlessness. The garden gave onto fields at the back. A hedge divided the two spaces. Merrily did not know that from behind the hedge, two pairs of green eyes were fixed on the perambulator. Babies make a lot of washing, and Merrily was a hard-working and devoted mother. Every day she was out in the garden, putting the washing out and taking it in. From the kitchen window, as she washed napkins and vests in the sink, she kept an eye on the fine perambulator, outdoors in the sun. Every 5 minutes, it seemed, she was nipping outdoors to adjust the hood, tuck in an extra blanket, or simply sing. Merrily was not the only one who was devoted to the perambulator. Emmeline and Adeline were besotted. Merrily emerged one day from under the back porch with a basket of washing under one arm, and the perambulator wasn't there. She halted abruptly. Her mouth opened, and her hands came up to her cheeks. The basket tumbled into the flower bed, tipping collars and socks into the wallflowers. Merrily never looked once toward the fence and the brambles. She turned her head left and right, as if she couldn't believe her eyes. Left and right, left and right, left and right, all the time with the panic building up inside her, and in the end she let out a shriek, a high-pitched noise that rose into the blue sky as if it could rend it in two. Mr. Griffin looked up from his vegetable plot and came to the fence, three doors down. Next door, old Granny Stokes frowned at the kitchen sink and came out onto her porch. Astounded, they looked at Merrily, wondering whether their laughing neighbour was really capable of making such a sound. And she looked wildly back at them, dumbstruck, as though her cry had used up a lifetime supply of words. Eventually, she said it. My baby's gone. And once the words were out, they sprang into action. Mr. Griffin jumped over three fences in a flash, took Merrily by the arm, and led her around to the front of her house, saying, "Gone? Where's he gone?" Granny Stokes disappeared from her back porch, and a second later her voice floated in the air from the front garden, calling out for help. And then a growing hubbub. "What is it? What's happened?" "Taken from the garden in the perambulator. You two go that way, and you others go that way. Run and fetch her husband, somebody." All the noise, all the commotion at the front of the house. At the back, everything was quiet. Merrily's washing bobbed about in the lazy sunshine. Mr. Griffin's spade rested tranquilly in the well-turned soil. Emmeline caressed the silver spokes in blind, quiet ecstasy, and Adeline kicked her out of the way so that they could get the thing moving. They had a name for it. It was the Voom. They dragged the perambulator along the backs of the houses. It was harder than they had thought. For a start, the pram was heavier than it appeared, and also they were pulling it along very uneven ground. The edge of the field was slightly banked, which tilted the pram at an angle. They could have put all four wheels on the level, but the newly turned earth was softer there, and the wheels sank into the clods of soil. Thistles and brambles snagged in the spokes and slowed them down, and it was a miracle that they kept going after the first 20 yards. But they were in their element. They pushed with all their might to get that pram home, gave it all their strength, and hardly seemed to feel the effort at all. They made their fingers bleed, tearing the thistles away from the wheels, but on they went, Emmeline still crooning her love song to it, giving it a surreptitious stroke with her fingers from time to time, kissing it. At last they came to the end of the fields, and the house was in sight. But instead of making directly for it, they turned toward the slopes of the deer park. They wanted to play. When they had pushed the pram to the top of the longest slope, with their indefatigable energy, they set it in position. They lifted out the baby and put it on the ground, and Adeline heaved herself into the carriage. Chin on knees, holding on to the sides, she was white-faced. At a signal from her eyes, Emmeline gave the pram the most powerful push she could manage. At first the pram went slowly. The ground was rough, and the slope up here was slight. But then the pram picked up speed. The black carriage flashed in the late sun as the wheels turned, faster and faster, until the spokes became a blur, and then not even a blur. The incline became steeper, and the bumps in the ground caused the pram to shake from side to side and threaten to take off. A noise filled the air. Adeline shrieking with pleasure as the pram hurtled downhill, shaking her bones and rattling her senses. Suddenly it was clear what was going to happen. One of the wheels struck against a piece of rock sticking out from the soil. There was a spark as metal screeched against stone, and the pram suddenly was speeding not downhill, but through the air, flying into the sun, wheels upward. It traced a serene curve against the blue of the sky, until the moment when the ground heaved up violently to snatch it, and there came the sickening sound of something breaking. After the echo of Adeline's exhilaration reverberating in the sky, everything was suddenly very quiet. Emmeline ran down the hill. The wheel facing the sky was buckled and half wrenched off. The other was still turning slowly, all its urgency lost. A white arm extended from the crushed cavity of the black carriage and rested at a strange angle on the stony ground. On the hand were purple bramble stains and thistle scratches. Emmeline knelt. Inside the crushed cavity of the carriage, all was dark. But there was movement a pair of green eyes staring back. "Voom," she said, and she smiled. The game was over. It was time to go home.
Aside from the story itself, Miss Winter spoke little in our meetings. In the early days I used to say, "How are you?" on arriving in the library, but she only said, "Ill, how are you?" with a bad-tempered edge to her voice, as though I was a fool for asking. I never answered her question, and she didn't expect me to, so the exchanges soon came to an end. I would sidle in, exactly a minute early, take my place in the chair on the other side of the fire, and take my notebook out of my bag. Then, with no preamble at all, she would pick up her story wherever she had left off. The end of these sessions was not governed by the clock. Sometimes Miss Winter would speak until she reached a natural break at the end of an episode. She would pronounce the last words, and the cessation of her voice had a finality about it that was unmistakable. It was followed by a silence as unambiguous as the white space at the end of a chapter. I would make a last note in my book, close the cover, gather my things together, and take my leave. At other times, though, she would break off unexpectedly, in the middle of a scene, sometimes in the middle of a sentence, and I would look up to see her white face tightly drawn into a mask of endurance. "Is there anything I can do?" I asked, the first time I saw her like this. But she just closed her eyes and gestured for me to go. When she finished telling me the story of Merrily and the perambulator, I put my pencil and notebook into my bag, and standing up said, "I shall be going away for a few days."
"No."
She was severe. "I'm afraid I must. I was only expecting to be here for a few days initially, and I've been here for over a week. I don't have enough things with me for a prolonged stay."
"Maurice can take you to town to buy whatever you need."
"I need my books." She gestured at her library shelves. I shook my head. "I'm sorry, but I really have to go." "Miss Lee, you seem to think that we have all the time in the world. Perhaps you do, but let me remind you I am a busy woman. I do not want to hear any more talk of going away. Let that be the end of it." I bit my lip and for a moment felt cowed, but I rallied. "Remember our agreement? 3 true things. I need to do some checking." She hesitated.
"You don't believe me?"
I ignored her question. 3 true things that I could check. You gave me your word." Her lips tightened in anger, but she concurred.
"You may leave on Monday. 3 days. No more. Maurice will take you to the station."
I was in the middle of writing up the story of Merrily and the perambulator when there came a knock at my door. It wasn't time for dinner, so I was surprised. Judith had never interrupted my work before. "Would you come to the drawing room?" she asked. "Dr. Clifton is here. He would like a word with you." As I entered the room, the man I had already seen arriving at the house rose to his feet. I'm no good at shaking hands, so I was glad when he seemed to decide not to offer me his, but it left us at a loss to find some other way to start.
"You are Miss Winter's biographer, I understand."
"I'm not sure."
"Not sure?"
"If she's telling me the truth, then I am her biographer. Otherwise, I'm just an amanuensis."
"Hmm." He paused. "Does it matter?"
"To whom?"
"To you."
I didn't know, but I knew his question was impertinent, so I didn't answer it. "You are Miss Winter's doctor, I suppose."
"I am."
"Why have you asked to see me?"
"It is Miss Winter, actually, who has asked me to see you. She wants me to make sure you are fully aware of her state of health."
"I see." With unflinching, scientific clarity, he proceeded to his explanation. In a few words, he told me the name of the illness that was killing her, the symptoms she suffered, the degree of her pain, and the hours of the day at which it was most and least effectively masked by the drugs. He mentioned a number of other conditions she suffered from, serious enough in themselves to kill her, except that the other disease was going to get there first. And he set out, as far as he was able, the likely progression of the illness, the need to ration the increases in dosage in order to have something in reserve for later, when, as he put it, she would really need it. "How long?" I asked, when his explanation came to an end. "I can't tell you. Another person would have succumbed already. Miss Winter is made of strong stuff. And since you have been here..." He broke off with the air of someone who finds himself inadvertently on the brink of breaking a confidence. "Since I have been here?" He looked at me and seemed to wonder, then made up his mind. "Since you have been here, she seems to be managing a little better. She says it is the anesthetic qualities of storytelling." I wasn't sure what to make of this. Before I could examine my thoughts, the doctor was continuing. "I understand you were going away. Is that why she's asked you to speak to me? It is only that she wants you to understand that time is of the essence. You can let her know that I understand." Our interview over, he held the door as I left, and as I passed him, he addressed me once more, in an unexpected whisper. "The 13th tale, I don't suppose..." In his otherwise impassive face, I caught a flash of the feverish impatience of the reader. "She has said nothing about it," I said, "though even if she had, I wouldn't be at liberty to tell you." His eyes cooled, and a tremor ran from his mouth to the corner of his nose. "Good day, Miss Lee."
"Good day, Doctor."
Doctor and Mrs. Maudsley. On my last day, Miss Winter told me about Dr. and Mrs. Maudsley.
Leaving gates open and wandering into other people's houses was one thing. Walking off with a baby in its pram was quite another. The fact that the baby, when it was found, was discovered to be none the worse for its temporary disappearance was beside the point. Things had got out of hand. Action was called for. The villagers didn't feel able to approach Charlie directly about it. They understood that things were strange at the house, and they were half afraid to go there. Whether it was Charlie or Isabel or the ghost that encouraged them to keep their distance is hard to say. Instead, they approached Dr. Maudsley. This was not the doctor whose failure to arrive promptly may or may not have caused the death in childbirth of Isabel's mother, but a new man who had served the village for 8 or 9 years at this time. Dr. Maudsley was not young, yet though he was in his middle 40s, he gave the impression of youth. He was not tall, not really very muscular, but he had an air of vitality, of vigour about him. His legs were long for his body, and he used to stride along at a great pace with no apparent effort. He could walk faster than anyone, had grown used to finding himself talking into thin air, and turning to find his walking companion scurrying along a few yards behind his back, panting with the effort of keeping up. This physical energy was matched by a great mental liveliness. You could hear the power of his brain in his voice, which was quiet but quick, with a facility for finding the right words for the right person at the right time. You could see it in his eyes, dark brown and very shiny like a bird's eyes, observant, intent, with strong, neat eyebrows above. Maudsley had a knack of spreading his energy around him. That's no bad thing for a doctor. His step on the path, his knock at the door, and his patients would start feeling better already. And not least, they liked him. He was a tonic in himself. That's what people said. It made a difference to him whether his patients lived or died, and when they lived, which was nearly always, it mattered how well they lived. Dr. Maudsley had a great love of intellectual activity. Illness was a kind of puzzle to him, and he couldn't rest until he'd solved it. Patients got used to him turning up at their houses first thing in the morning when he'd spent the night puzzling over their symptoms to ask one more question. And once he'd worked out a diagnosis, then there was the treatment to resolve. He consulted the books, of course, was fully cognizant of all the usual treatments, but he had an original mind that kept coming back to something as simple as a sore throat from a different angle, constantly casting about for the tiny fragment of knowledge that would enable him not only to get rid of the sore throat, but to understand the phenomenon of the sore throat in an entirely new light. Energetic, intelligent and amiable, he was an exceptionally good doctor and a better than average man. Though, like all men, he had his blind spot. The delegation of village men included the baby's father, his grandfather and the publican, a weary-looking fellow who didn't like to be left out of anything. Dr. Maudsley welcomed the trio and listened attentively as two of the three men recounted their tale. They began with the gates left open, went on to the vexed issue of the missing saucepans, and arrived after some minutes at the climax of their story, the kidnapping of the infant in the perambulator. "They're running wild," the younger Fred Jameson said finally. "Out of control," added the older Fred Jameson. "And what do you say?" asked Dr. Maudsley of the third man. Wilfred Bonner, standing to one side, had until now remained silent. Mr. Bonner took his cap off and drew in a slow, whistling breath. "Well, I'm no medical man, but it seems to me them girls is not right." He accompanied his words with a look full of significance, then, in case he hadn't got his message across, tapped his bald head once, twice, three times. All three men looked gravely at their shoes. "Leave it with me," said the doctor. "I'll speak to the family." And the men left. They had done their bit. It was up to the doctor, the village elder now. Though he'd said he would speak to the family, what the doctor actually did was speak to his wife. "I doubt they meant any harm by it," she said, when he had finished telling the story. "You know what girls are. A baby is so much more fun to play with than a doll. They wouldn't have hurt him. Still, they must be told not to do it again. Poor Mary." And she lifted her eyes from her sewing and turned her face to her husband. Mrs. Maudsley was an exceedingly attractive woman. She had large brown eyes with long lashes that curled prettily, and her dark hair, that had not a trace of grey in it, was pulled back in a style of such simplicity that only a true beauty would not be made plain by it. When she moved, her form had a rounded womanly grace. The doctor knew his wife was beautiful, but they had been married too long for it to make any difference to him. "They think in the village that the girls are mentally retarded." "Surely not. It's what Wilfred Bonner thinks, at least." She shook her head in wonderment. "He is afraid of them because they are twins. Poor Wilfred. It is just old-fashioned ignorance. Thank goodness the younger generation is more understanding." The doctor was a man of science. Though he knew it was statistically unlikely that there was any mental abnormality in the twins, he would not rule it out until he had seen them. It did not surprise him, though, that his wife, whose religion forbade her to believe ill of anyone, would take for granted that the rumour was ill-founded gossip. "I'm sure you are right," he murmured with a vagueness that meant he was sure she was wrong. He had given up trying to get her to believe only what was true. She had been raised to the kind of religion that could admit no difference between what was true and what was good. "What will you do then?" she asked him. "Go and see the family. Charles Angelfield is a bit of a hermit, but he'll have to see me if I go." Mrs. Maudsley nodded, which was her way of disagreeing with her husband, though he didn't know it. "What about the mother? What do you know of her?" "Very little." And the doctor continued to think in silence, and Mrs. Maudsley continued her sewing, and after a quarter of an hour had passed, the doctor said, "Perhaps you might go, Theodora. The mother might sooner see another woman than a man. What do you say?" And so 3 days later, Mrs. Maudsley arrived at the house and knocked at the front door. Astonished to get no answer, she frowned. After all, she had sent a note to say she was coming, and walked round to the back. The kitchen door was ajar, so with a quick knock she went in. No one was there. Mrs. Maudsley looked around. 3 apples on the table, brown and wrinkled, and starting to collapse upon themselves. A black dishcloth next to a sink piled high with dirty plates, and the window so filthy that inside you could hardly tell day from night. Her dainty white nose sniffed the air. It told her everything she needed to know. She pursed her lips, set her shoulders, took a tight grip on the tortoiseshell handle of her bag, and set off on her crusade. She went from room to room looking for Isabel, but on the way, taking in the squalor, the mess, the unkemptness that lurked everywhere. The missus tired easily, and she couldn't manage the stairs very well, and her sight was going, and she often thought she had cleaned things when she hadn't, or meant to clean them and then forgot. And to be honest, she knew nobody really cared. So she mostly concentrated on feeding the girls, and they were lucky she managed that much. So the house was dirty, and it was dusty, and when a picture was knocked wonky, it stayed wonky for a decade, and when one day Charlie couldn't find the paper bin in his study, he just dropped the paper onto the floor in the place where the paper bin used to be. And it soon occurred to him that it was less fuss to chuck it out once a year than to do it once a week. Mrs. Maudsley didn't like what she saw at all. She frowned at the half-closed curtains and sighed at the tarnished silver, and shook her head in amazement at the saucepans on the stairs and the sheet music that was scattered all over the floor of the hallway. In the drawing-room, she bent down automatically to retrieve a playing card, the 3 of spades, that was lying dropped or discarded in the middle of the floor. But when she looked around the room for the rest of the pack, she was at a loss, so great was the disorder. Glancing helplessly back at the card, she became aware of the dust covering it, and being a fastidious, white-gloved woman, was overwhelmed with the desire to put it down. Only where? For a few seconds she was paralysed with anxiety, torn between the desire to end the contact between her pristine glove and the dusty, faintly sticky playing card, and her own unwillingness to put the card down in a place that wasn't the right one. Eventually, with a perceptible shudder of the shoulders, she placed it on the arm of the leather-armed chair and walked with relief out of the room. The library seemed better. It was dusty, certainly, and the carpet was threadbare, but the books themselves were in their places, which was something. Yet even in the library, just when she was preparing herself to believe that there remained some small feeling for order buried in this filthy, chaotic family, she came across a makeshift bed. tucked into a dark corner between two sets of shelves. It was just a flea-ridden blanket and a filthy pillow, and at first she took it for a cat's bed. Then, looking again, she spotted the corner of a book visible beneath the pillow. She drew it out. It was Jane Eyre. From the library she passed to the music room, where she found the same disorder she had seen elsewhere. The furniture was arranged bizarrely, as though to facilitate the playing of hide-and-seek. A chaise longue was turned to face a wall. A chair was half-hidden by a chest that had been dragged from its place under the window. There was a broad sweep of carpet behind it, where the dust was less thick, and the green colour showed through more distinctly. On the piano, a vase contained blackened, brittle stems, and around it a neat circle of papery petals like ashes. Mrs. Maudsley reached her hand toward one and picked it up. It crumbled, leaving a nasty yellow-grey stain between her white-gloved fingers. Mrs. Maudsley seemed to slump down onto the piano stool. The doctor's wife wasn't a bad woman. She was sufficiently convinced of her own importance to believe that God actually did watch everything she did and listen to everything she said. And she was so taken up with rooting out the pride she was prone to feeling in her own holiness to notice any other failings she might have had. She was a do-gooder, which means that all the ill she did without realizing it. What was going on in her mind as she sat there on the piano stool staring into space? These were people who couldn't keep their flower vases topped up. No wonder their children were misbehaving. The extent of the problem seemed suddenly to have been revealed to her through the dead flowers, and it was in a distracted, absent fashion that she pulled off her gloves and spread her fingers on the black and grey keys of the piano. The sound that resounded in the room was the harshest, most un-piano-like noise imaginable. This was in part because the piano had been neglected, unplayed and untuned for many years. It was also because the vibration of the instrument's strings was instantly accompanied by another noise equally unmelodic. It was a kind of a howling hiss, an irritated, wild sort of a screech, like that of a cat whose tail has got under your feet. Mrs. Maudsley was shaken entirely out of her reverie by it. On hearing the yowl, she stared at the piano in disbelief and stood up, her hands to her cheeks. In her bewilderment, she had only the barest moment to register that she was not alone. There, rising from the chaise longue, a slight figure in white. Poor Mrs. Maudsley. She had not the time to appreciate that the white-robed figure was brandishing a violin, and that the violin was descending very quickly and with great force toward her own head. Before she could take in any of this, the violin made contact with her skull. Blackness overwhelmed her, and she fell unconscious to the floor. With her arms sprawled any old how, and her neat white handkerchief still tucked inside her watch strap, she looked as though there wasn't a drop of life left in her. Little puffs of dust that had come up from the carpet when she had landed fell gently back down. There she lay for a good half hour, until the missus, back from the farm where she had been to collect eggs, happened to glance in at the door and see a dark shape where she hadn't seen a dark shape before. There was no sign of a figure in white.
As I transcribed from memory, Miss Winter's voice seemed to fill my room with the same degree of reality with which it had filled the library. She had a way of speaking that engraved itself on my memory, and was as reliable as a phonograph recording. But at this point, where she said there was no sign of a figure in white, she had paused, and so now I paused, pencil hovering above the page, as I considered what had happened next. I had been engrossed in the story, and so it took me a moment to refocus my eye from the prone figure of the doctor's wife in the story to the storyteller herself. When I did, I was dismayed. Miss Winter's normal pallor had given way to an ugly yellow-grey tint, and her frame, always rigid, it must be said, seemed at present to be girding itself against some invisible assault. There was a trembling around her mouth, and I guessed that she was on the point of losing the struggle to hold her lips in a firm line, and that a repressed grimace was close to winning the day. I rose from my chair in alarm, but had no idea what I ought to do. "Miss Winter?" I exclaimed helplessly. "Whatever is it?" "My wolf," I thought I heard her say, but the effort to speak was enough to send her lips into a quiver. She closed her eyes, seemed to struggle to measure her breathing. Just as I was on the point of running to find Judith, Miss Winter regained control. The rise and fall of her chest slowed, the tremors in her face ceased, and though she was still pale as death, she opened her eyes and looked at me. "Better," she said weakly. Slowly I returned to my chair. "I thought you said something about a wolf," I began.
"Yes. That black beast that gnaws at my bones whenever he gets a chance. He loiters in corners and behind doors most of the time because he's afraid of these."
She indicated the white pills on the table beside her.
"But they don't last forever. It's nearly 12, and they are wearing off. He's sniffing at my neck. By 1:30 he will be digging his teeth and claws in. Until 1, when I can take another tablet, and he will have to return to his corner. We are always clock-watching, he and I. He pounces 5 minutes earlier every day. But I can't take my tablets 5 minutes earlier. That stays the same."
"But surely the doctor..."
"Of course. Once a week, or once every 10 days, he adjusts the dose. Only never quite enough. He doesn't want to be the one to kill me, you see. And so when it comes, it must be the wolf that finishes me off."
She looked at me, very matter-of-fact, then relented.
"The pills are here, look, and the glass of water. If I wanted to, I could put an end to it myself, whenever I chose. So don't feel sorry for me. I have chosen this way because I have things to do."
I nodded. "All right.
So, let's get on and do them, shall we? Where were we?"
"The doctor's wife. In the music room. With the violin." And we continued our work.
Charlie wasn't used to dealing with problems. He had problems, plenty of them. Holes in the roof, cracked window panes, pigeons mouldering away in the attic rooms. But he ignored them. Or perhaps was so far removed from the world that he just didn't notice them. When the water penetration got too bad, he just closed up a room and started using another one. The house was big enough, after all. One wonders whether in his slow-moving mind he realized that other people actively maintained their homes. But then dilapidation was his natural environment. He felt at home in it. Still, a doctor's wife apparently dead in the music room was a problem he couldn't ignore. If it had been one of us, but an outsider, that was another matter. Something had to be done, although he had no notion of what that something might be, and he stared, stricken, at the doctor's wife as she put her hand to her throbbing head and moaned. He might be stupid, but he knew what this meant. Calamity was coming. The missus sent John the Dig for the doctor, and in due course the doctor arrived. And it seemed for a while that premonitions of disaster were ill-founded, for it was found that the doctor's wife was not badly hurt at all, barely even concussed. She refused a tot of brandy, accepted tea, and after a short while was as right as rain. "It was a woman," she said, "a woman in white." "Nonsense," said the missus, at once reassuring and dismissive. "There is no woman in white in the house." Tears glittered in Mrs. Maudsley's brown eyes, but she was adamant. "Yes, a woman, slightly built, there on the chaise longue. She heard the piano and rose up and..." "Did you see her for long?" Dr. Maudsley asked. "No, it was just for a moment." "Well, then, you see, it cannot be." The missus interrupted her, and though her voice was sympathetic, it was also firm. "There is no woman in white. You must have seen a ghost." And then for the first time John the Dig's voice was heard. "They do say that the house is haunted." For a moment the assembled group looked at the broken violin abandoned on the floor, and considered the lump that was forming on Mrs. Maudsley's temple. But before anyone had time to respond to the theory, Isabel appeared in the doorway. Slim and willowy, she was wearing a pale lemon dress. Her haphazard topknot was unkempt, and her eyes, though beautiful, were wild. "Could this be the person you saw?" the doctor asked his wife. Mrs. Maudsley measured Isabel against the picture in her mind. How many shades separate white from pale yellow? Where exactly is the borderline between slight and slim? How might a blow to the head affect a person's memory? She wavered. Then, seeing the emerald eyes and finding an exact match in her memory, decided. "Yes, this is the person." The missus and John the Dig avoided exchanging a glance. From that moment, forgetting his wife, it was Isabel the doctor attended to. He looked at her closely, kindly, with worry in the back of his eyes, while he asked her question after question. When she refused to answer, he was unrattled. But when she was bothered to reply, by turns arch, impatient, nonsensical, he listened carefully, nodding as he made notes in his doctor's pad. Taking her wrist to measure her pulse, he noted with alarm the cuts and scars that marked the inside of her forearm. "Does she do this herself?" Reluctantly honest, the missus murmured, "Yes." And the doctor pressed his lips into a worried line. "May I have a word with you, sir?" he asked, turning to Charlie. Charlie looked blankly at him, but the doctor took him by the elbow. "The library, perhaps?" and led him firmly out of the room. In the drawing room, the missus and the doctor's wife waited and pretended not to pay any attention to the sounds that came from the library. There was the hum, not of voices, but of a single voice, calm and measured. When it stopped, we heard, "No!" and again, "No!" in Charlie's raised voice, and then again the low tones of the doctor. They were gone for some time, and we heard Charlie's protestations over and over before the door opened and the doctor came out, looking serious and shaken. Behind him, there was a great howl of despair and impotence, but the doctor only winced and pulled the door closed behind him. I'll make the arrangements with the asylum, he told the missus. Leave the transport to me. Will 2 o'clock be all right? Baffled, she nodded her head, and the doctor's wife rose to leave. At 2 o'clock, 3 men came to the house, and they led Isabel out to a broom in the drive. She submitted herself to them like a lamb, settled obediently in the seat, never even looked out as the horses trotted slowly down the drive toward the lodge gates. The twins, unconcerned, were drawing circles with their toes in the gravel of the drive. Charlie stood on the steps watching the broom as it grew smaller and smaller. He had the air of a child whose favourite toy is being taken away, and who cannot believe, not quite, not yet, that it is really happening. From the hall, the missus and John the Dig watched him anxiously, waiting for the realization to dawn. The car reached the lodge gates and disappeared through them. Charlie continued to stare at the open gates for 3, 4, 5 seconds. Then his mouth opened. A wide circle, twitching and trembling, that revealed his quivering tongue, the fleshy redness of his throat, strings of spittle across a dark cavity. Mesmerized, we watched, waiting for the awful noise to emerge from the gaping, juddering mouth. But the sound was not ready to come. For long seconds it built up, accumulating inside him until his whole body seemed full of pent-up sound. At long last, he fell to his knees on the steps, and the cry emerged from him. It was not the elephantine bellow we were expecting, but a damp nasal snort. The girls looked up from their toe circles for a moment, then returned impassively to them. John the Dig tightened his lips and turned away, heading back to the garden and work. There was nothing for him to do here. The missus went to Charlie, placed a consoling hand on his shoulder, and attempted to persuade him into the house. But he was deaf to her words, and only snuffled and squeaked like a thwarted schoolboy. And that was that.
That was that. The words were a curiously understated endnote to the disappearance of Miss Winter's mother. It was clear that Miss Winter didn't think much of Isabel's abilities as a parent. Indeed, the word mother seemed absent from her lexicon. Perhaps it was understandable. From what I could see, Isabel was the least maternal of women. But who was I to judge other people's relations with their mothers? I closed my book, slid my pencil into the spiral, and stood up. I'll be away for 3 days, I reminded her. I'll be back on Thursday. And I left her alone with her wolf. Dickens' Study. I finished writing up that day's notes. All dozen pencils were blunt now. I had some serious sharpening to do. One by one, I inserted lead ends into the sharpener. If you turn the handle slowly and evenly, you can sometimes get the coil of lead-edged wood to twist and dangle in a single drop all the way to the paper bin. But tonight I was tired, and they kept breaking under their own weight. I thought about the story. I had warmed to the missus and John the Dig. Charlie and Isabel made me nervous. The doctor and his wife had the best of motives, but I suspected their intervention in the lives of the twins would come to no good. The twins themselves puzzled me. I knew what other people thought of them. John the Dig thought they couldn't speak properly. The missus believed they didn't understand other people were alive. The villagers thought they were wrong in the head. What I didn't know, and this was more than curious, was what the storyteller thought. In telling her tale, Miss Winter was like the light that illuminates everything but itself. She was the disappearing point at the heart of the narrative, She spoke of they. More recently, she had spoken of we. The absence that perplexed me was I. What could it be that had caused her to distance herself from her story in this way? If I were to ask her about it, I knew what she would say.
Miss Lee, we made an agreement.
Already I'd asked her questions about one or two details of the story, and though from time to time she would answer, when she didn't want to, she would remind me of our first meeting. No cheating, no looking ahead, no questions. I reconciled myself to remaining curious for a long time, and yet as it happened, something happened that very evening that cast a certain illumination on the matter. I had tidied my desk and was setting about my packing when there came a tap on my door. I opened it to find Judith in the corridor.
"Miss Winter wonders whether you have time to see her for a moment."
This was Judith's polite translation of a more abrupt, "Fetch Miss Lee." I was in no doubt. I finished folding a blouse and went down to the library. Miss Winter was seated in her usual position, and the fire was blazing, but otherwise the room was in darkness. "Would you like me to put some lights on?" I asked from the doorway.
"No."
Her answer came distantly to my ears, and so I walked down the aisle toward her. The shutters were open, and the dark sky, pricked all over with stars, was reflected in the mirrors. When I arrived beside her, the dancing light from the fire showed me that Miss Winter was distracted. In silence I sat in my place, lulled by the warmth of the fire, staring into the night sky reflected in the library mirrors. A quarter of an hour passed while she ruminated, and I waited. Then she spoke.
"Have you ever seen that picture of Dickens in his study? It's by a man called Buss, I believe. I have a reproduction of it somewhere. I'll look it out for you.